Now, the president's direct involvement in Chicago's Olympic bid has raised some questions. Earlier this week, White House spokesman Robert Gibbs was asked to justify the president's trip to Copenhagen.
Obviously, any Olympics showcases the country that those Olympics are in, and there's a tangible economic benefit to those games being here, and the president wants to help out America's bid.
Sounds automatic, but there is actually some question about whether hosting an Olympics provides measurable benefits, as NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Every Olympics begins with a magic moment 7 years before any athlete marches in an opening ceremony.
Well, the International Olympic Committee has decided to award the organization of the 19th Olympic Winter Games in 2002 to the city of Salt Lake.
And this moment only comes after Olympic boosters promise great economic benefits for cities hosting the Games. We'll reap more than we spend, they say. But those who've looked at the numbers say the promise is almost never fulfilled.
There has never been an Olympic Games that has made a profit when you fold all the costs in against all the revenues.
Robert Barney directs the International Center for Olympic Studies at the University of Western Ontario, and he includes in his assessment the 1984 Summer Games in Los Angeles, which is widely hailed for its $233 million surplus. But that only includes the direct costs of staging the Olympics. There were also indirect costs for security and infrastructure paid by city, state, and federal governments.
Fold all the monies, including federal allotments, municipal allotments, provincial or state allotments. It's always been that a debt has to be paid somewhere.
It took Montreal 30 years to pay off its Olympic debts from the 1976 Games. Nagano, Japan spent so much for the 1998 Winter Games, and that spending triggered so much suspicion, organizers destroyed their financial records. Economist Andrew Rose at Berkeley's Haas School of Business has combed Olympic records and economic data for evidence of benefits.
No reasonable person thinks that the direct benefits of hosting the Olympic Games or any other mega event cover the costs. You have to have some enormous indirect benefit, and that's what we've been focusing on in our research.
The one demonstrable and sustained indirect economic benefit Rose and his colleagues found is an increase in international trade, not more tourism or new industries, the kinds of things Olympic boosters promote. Olympic host cities have seen, on average, a 30% rise in exports. That also applies to cities bidding for but not winning the games, so even the losers benefit.
When a country submits a serious bid to host the Olympics, what they're really doing is signaling that they're open for business and they're going to become internationally integrated and a serious member of the international community.
Rose found significant exceptions, wealthy countries like the United States and nations that have hosted multiple Olympics. Cities hoping to host the Games also seek to boost what might be a sagging self-image as well as an international profile. Chicago is a prime example, says economist Alan Sanderson at the University of Chicago.
I was in Tokyo recently giving some lectures and walked into small neighborhood bars and somebody asked where we were from and we said Chicago and they said, oh, Al Capone. This would be a chance to turn away from the Al Capone image of Chicago.
Or reinforce the image of political corruption and patronage if Chicago becomes the host city and resorts to its traditional way of doing things. Olympic bidding could come with this warning, satisfaction not guaranteed. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
Apparently there will be no successor owner to the Saturn car brand. That's the upsetting news that General Motors released yesterday. Its plan to sell its Saturn division to the auto retail giant Penske Automotive Group fell through. Roger Penske backed out. This surprise announcement almost certainly means the end of Saturn. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports.
General Motors started Saturn in 1983 to try to win back customers who'd developed a taste for small, fuel-efficient, and reliable Japanese cars. Saturn's no-hassle, no-haggle sales approach was popular, but late last year, a struggling GM said Saturn was one of the brands it had to let go. This summer, former race car driver Roger Penske said his auto retail group, Penske Automotive, would buy Saturn and contract with other car manufacturers to make Saturns once GM was out of the picture. That would have been a unique business model for the auto industry. Dan Januska runs 4 Saturn stores in Arizona. He says as of Wednesday morning, everything looked good.
We were all excited about it. We had airfare set up. We were going to meet Roger, and he was going to go over his plans.
But things changed fast. Late Wednesday afternoon, Penske Automotive said an agreement with another auto company to make Saturn cars had been rejected by that company's board of directors. Published reports say the company was Renault. Without that deal, acquiring Saturn was just too risky. The deal was dead. Some Saturn dealers say this didn't have to happen. In their view, Saturn could have been a shining star in the GM lineup had the company not starved the division of new products. But other dealers say blaming GM won't do any good. Todd Ingersoll owns two dealerships in Connecticut.
Do you think, well, geez, if we had had a different car sooner, or if that one had come out faster, if we had more money in advertising? Sure, you could play Monday morning quarterback. But the simple fact of the matter is, that wasn't in the cards.
Also not in the cards, a new way of delivering cars to customers. Eric Merkel is president of Autoconomy.com. He seriously doubted that this kind of private label concept was realistic for an auto company, especially right now.
There's just so many competitors out there now, so many automakers that eventually some of those automakers have to go away, and then the larger ones or the more prosperous ones then survive.
A spokesman for General Motors says everyone there was surprised, shocked, and disappointed by the sudden turn of events. The automaker will return to its fallback plan and stop making new Saturns in a few weeks. Saturn dealers have until the end of next year to wind down, but with inventories at low levels right now, many Saturn dealerships could close their doors within months. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton.
Interactive television is a marketing term, perhaps a marketing dream, that's been around for years. The idea is that if couch potatoes see something they like in a commercial, they can click on their remote to buy it. That idea is becoming more of a reality. In the first large-scale rollout, a New York cable company next week will offer an early version of this service to its digital subscribers. Jesse Baker has more from New York.
It was supposed to be the Jennifer Aniston effect, back when Friends was still on NBC.
Well, excuse me, my fashion-impaired friends. I am here to tell you that hats are back.
Aniston was the trend-setting, haircut-inspiring Rachel Green. The idea was that viewers could see her wearing a sweater or a skirt they liked and use their TV remotes to buy it. The idea never quite materialized before Friends went off the air, but the promise of interactive TV still lingers. The media giant Cablevision next week is rolling out to millions of its cable subscribers interactive commercials.
With a simple push of the select button, get coupons, information, and even free samples delivered right to your door. Optimum Select, coming this fall from IOTV.
We made a conscious effort to not oversell and not overpromise what Optimum Select can do.
That's Cablevision's Gemma Toner.
And as part of our marketing strategy, we actually are truly delivering the products so that when they press select, we're not telling them they can get a coupon. We are actually delivering that coupon to them.
Just to be clear, you can't actually buy products off these commercials just yet. You can ask for more information or request a free sample of things like Benjamin Moore paint. It is one of a handful of national brands airing interactive ads across 25 cable networks in the greater New York area. Sam Craig is a marketing professor at New York University, and he thinks these types of ads would most appeal to a certain kind of viewer.
Someone that you'd categorize as an impulsive person. Someone that's very deliberate, that takes time to make decisions, is not going to respond to something on the television.
And Craig says, imagine how much product QVC could push if shoppers could just hit a purchase button on their remotes.
J140434 is the item number. Stay on the line for that one, and we're going to go right into the earrings that you could wear with it.
Interactive marketing seems destined to appeal to the infomercial clientele. You know, the same people who would order a Snuggie for their dog?
So how do you keep your dog warm when they're feeling a chill? Now there's Snuggie Dog, the little blanket with sleeves designed to fit your dog.
Cablevision would love for you to just press a button on your remote and buy a Snuggie. But that's not where they are yet. And Cablevision's Gemma Toner says don't expect these commercials to revolutionize the advertising world. For now, she's happy with interactive baby steps.
But I think in the beginning, we should just be realistic and conscious of how consumers are thinking about this and how they react to it.
Cablevision's first big challenge, though, will be reprogramming consumers' relationships with their remotes. So when you see a commercial, learning to press the select button and resisting the urge to hit fast forward. For NPR News, I'm Jessie Baker in New York.
Every country in the European Union has now approved what amounts to a constitution for Europe. Every country except one, Ireland, said no the first time around. The Irish voters are going back to the polls today. If the constitution is approved, it would lay out how the EU would develop. NPR's Rob Gifford reports on what's at stake.
Few people in Europe really know what the European Union does, and few people have read the Lisbon Treaty. It's full of commitments to streamline the EU and make it more accountable, and to cooperate on a range of different issues, from the environment to fighting organized crime. The treaty will also bring in an EU president. Tony Blair is apparently interested in the job, and a foreign policy chief to help Europe speak more with one voice. Plenty of people here in Dublin, like law student Dan Hayden, think it's a great document.
I'll be voting yes. Yes, please.
Why?
Personally, I can only speak about the personal things that matter to me. Climate change. Like, I think it seems so common sense that states need to work together on this. Energy security. Researching clean technologies. I want to see sharing between different European states that can pool their resources. Those are all good reforms.
The Irish people have already voted on the Lisbon Treaty once before, last year, and rejected it. But so important is it for the EU that concessions were made to the Irish government on a number of issues, and Dublin agreed to present it to its people again. In the interim, though, the Irish economy almost collapsed. Now, big business is pushing even harder for a yes vote. Michael O'Leary is the founder of cut-price airline Ryanair and one of Ireland's most successful businessmen.
We're bankrupt. The only difference between Iceland and Ireland is not one letter, but our membership of Europe and our membership of the Euro. The people who are bailing us out are Europe and the European Central Bank.
This argument and the argument that passing the Lisbon Treaty is almost a precondition for recovery has swayed many. And it may be enough to push the treaty through, but it has by no means persuaded everyone.
We have made a request to the Department of Transport, to the Minister of Transport, for a meeting. If we don't get a response, or we get a negative response, this protest will escalate.
The tanking of the Irish economy has brought all sorts of people onto the streets here, such as taxi drivers protesting yesterday. For drivers like David Weaver, the problem is that the Lisbon Treaty gives too much power to Brussels. He says he will vote no again like he did last year.
It will have a devastating effect on all of society. Both our rights, our fundamental rights, our constitutional rights. What they're saying is might is right. The history of Europe can tell you what that leads to. It's not so long ago when the last person wanted an empire of Europe. We all know the consequences.
Such statements comparing the European Union with Hitler have become part of the general use of fear and emotion by both sides to promote their arguments. Professor Ben Tonra of University College Dublin sees parallels with recent debates in the United States.
So that, for example, in the US with your health debate and people talking about death panels and people talking about, you know, whether or not President Obama is legitimately president by virtue of his birth certificate, you have people here in Ireland today looking at the Lisbon Treaty. We're looking, you know, people making claims about abortion, about forced conscription into European armies, about cuts in our national minimum wage, none of which could or would happen, and everybody has said that. But nonetheless, people are emotionally engaged in this in a way that raises a lot of heat with very little light.
What Tonra and others worry is that the Irish, understandably angry at their government for its economic failures, could end up voting no on the treaty, even though the treaty may be in their best economic interests.
If there's a no vote, the Lisbon Treaty is dead, but the European project is in serious crisis. Because everything that the European Union plans to do for the next 5 to 10 years has been predicated on the passage of the Lisbon Treaty.
For decades, European countries have tried to resolve the tension between exercising their sovereignty while cooperating effectively in Europe. Clearly, that tension is as difficult as ever to maintain. If the no vote wins again, the concern is that cooperation with allies, especially the US, will suffer while the European Union regroups. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Dublin.